welcome, everyone, to the first in our series of webinars on the 2014 Farm Bill. Today, we will be presenting an overview of the Agricultural Act of 2014. This series is being brought to you through a consortium of cooperating organizations. Those include the Extension Risk Management Education Centers, the SARA 39 Multi-State Public Policy Issues Education Committee, the Agriculture and Applied Economics Association Extension Section, the Council on Food, Agriculture, and Resource Economics, the Regional Extension Farm Management Committees, and the Ag in Uncertain Times team with technology hosted by Montana State University and the University of Wyoming. I am John Hewlett, and I'll be serving as your host today. I'm a farm and ranch management specialist at the University of Wyoming, and it is indeed an honor to serve today as your moderator. And although I'm doing that, I'm only able to do so through the help and assistance of many others working behind the scenes to make these presentations possible. Our team members' support and the support of their respective institutions help to make these offerings a reality. Today we've got a great lineup of speakers, Dr. Vince Smith from Montana State University, Jonathan Coppice, University of Illinois, and Dr. Nathan Smith from the University of Georgia. I will give a more complete and more formal introduction to each of them as they begin their presentations, but we'll give you just a couple of tips on how to manage or work within the within this webinar room just before we get started. If you have any questions for the presenters, you may enter those in the chat window found at the lower left of your screen. And working with our behind-the-scenes team, I will then put those questions to our presenters as we come up to the end of their presentations, and we'll have a chance, I'm hoping, for a Q&A panel at the very end. So you can use that pod to enter any questions. Also, if you have any technical problems, as we all know, computers are a wonderful tool, certainly can help us overcome distances and solve problems, making webinars like this a possibility. But that same technology can also create a number of challenges. So if you're experiencing difficulties, please don't hesitate to contact our team for assistance in getting those resolved. Also, if you're having trouble reading the screen at any point in today's webinar, you may want to try the full screen button that's located in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. This button switches between the view that you see now and a view where the presentation slide fill the entire screen, making that smaller text somewhat easier to read. Please note that while you're in that full screen mode, you will be unable to see the chat window. If you just press that full screen button again, it should reveal the chat window so you can enter any questions that you might have. So at this point, we have a few questions we'd like to pose to the audience to get a little better feel for who all might be on. The first question asks what your occupation is, whether you're an agricultural producer, an educator, if you might be a banking professional or another sort of agribusiness professional, if you're involved with a commodity organization, perhaps a non-for-profit organization, government agency, or other, if none of those apply. If you wouldn't mind giving us a quick view of who all's on. I have quite a number of folks joining us today, so I appreciate your filling that out. Next question is where it is that you're located in terms of geography. Are you, yes, we've got choices here from the Northeast, Southeast, Midwest, Southwest, Western U.S., Pacific Islands, you have to be out in the islands, or if you're international, so you get a little feel for who all's involved in the webinar room this morning. Okay, thank you for those answers. Our next question is about your interest. So how are you currently involved in agriculture? Do you currently produce and market a food product? Are you involved in the processing, in the process of developing a food product and taking that to market? Or would you like to develop a food product to take to a market? Or perhaps an educator gathering more information? Or if none of those apply, I guess we have E is none of the above as a choice open to you. We have a number of responses. Thank you for those. And one final question, kind of a quick feel here for how many folks might be participating from your location. Nice that we can open these webinar rooms to as many folks as are interested in logging in, but we have no way of tracking how many people might be on. So it's a quick question to see how many individuals may be participating from your location, if it's 1, 2 to 5, 6 to 10, and on up, or if there are perhaps there are more than 20 in a meeting room situation. We have, looks like, a few of those as well. So just, again, to get a feel for how many folks may be participating here this morning. All right, so thank you for that. We'll move on now, in the interest of time, to our first presenter, and that would be Dr. Vince Smith, who is a professor of economics in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University, and is co-director of MSU's Agricultural Market Policy Center. He received his PhD from North Carolina State University in 1987 and his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Manchester in 1970 and 1971. Vince's current research program examines agricultural trade and domestic policy issues, with a particular focus on agricultural insurance, agricultural science policy, domestic and world commodity markets, risk management, and agricultural trade policy. He's authored and edited 9 books and monographs and published over 140 articles and book chapters on agricultural economics, agricultural policy, and other economic issues. In 2008, he became a distinguished scholar of the Western Agricultural Economics Association, and in 2011, he received the Bruce Gardner Award for outstanding contributions to the economic analysis work of the USDA. I've had a number of opportunities to work with Vince over the last decade, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome him today. Vince, with that, the floor is yours.
John, thank you very much. And good morning, and good morning, and almost good afternoon to everybody, at least the people on the East Coast. And hopefully you're all warmer than I am, because I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., where the weather is, as the English would say, just lovely. Below 20 and snowing, and nothing is working properly in D.C. Hopefully my hookup will work and we'll do well. The title I've chosen for the talk is deliberate. Where are we going and how are we going? And the answer is, we don't really know, not least because of all the choices that exist within the new policy environment created by the 2014 Farm Bill. So I thought I'd just list a few things that we do and we don't know. So what do we know? There's a farm bill. Well, that's a change, because we weren't quite sure if we were ever going to get one over the last 2 years. And it's been passed by both the House and the Senate. We know that. And it's been signed by the president. That is, President Obama. The bill's 930 pages plus long. But that's not really telling the whole story, because it's really over 2,000 pages, as much of the bill consists of amendments to previous legislation. And the bill will probably be 20,000 plus pages long by the time USDA has written all of the implementation rules and handbooks for each of the programs to be managed by agencies like the Farm Service Agency, NRCS, and the Risk Management Agency, which will have a lot of fun trying to sort out how to handle the special coverage option, which is a new insurance policy. What else do we know? Well, most of us haven't read all the bill. Some of us, none of it. And most of us never will read all the bill. It's pretty intimidating. And even if we've read it, we're pretty sure, most of us, that we don't understand what most of it means. And that includes, I think, the people in USDA who are trying to write the implementation rules, because there are some ambiguities, to put it mildly, in the language in some parts of the bill. This is an important issue in the following sense, in that we will not really know what choices farmers have until the implementation rules for signing up for different programs have been developed and published. And it's only then that we'll fully understand what the options facing farmers are. We do know the bill's new name. It's the Agricultural Act of 2014. But most of us won't remember the name, because we always call them farm bills. Most of us won't remember the act. We do know the bill's acronym. It will be AA, which has been used by at least one other very well-known organization and could be viewed as unfortunate, but is neither fair nor fact for those of us who remember the acronyms of previous farm bills. We do know that the Farm Bill creates a complicated set of choices for farmers. And those choices are complex in several dimensions, especially with respect to the programs that have been introduced in Title I and Title XI. Title I is the farm subsidy title that's traditionally thought of, where loan rates and so on are discussed and established and the legislation described. Title XI is the new title for the crop insurance program. Title XI is really quite incomplete in some senses because most of the legislation that guides crop insurance is to be found in other acts, for example, the Agricultural Risk Protection Act of 2000. For many farmers, where they have a choice about which program they can use, for example, price loss coverage, that's PLC, or agricultural risk coverage, that's ARC, right now neither neither they nor we know what they should do. And there's a big reason for this. No one really knows what the prices of corn, wheat, rice, peanuts, and other commodities will be over the next 5 years. And as I'll show you later on, not too much later on, because we're going to try and keep this talk to 30 minutes, there is a lot of ambiguity about what might happen with prices. And in fact, what prices for major commodities do determines which program would be providing the largest amount of payments for individual farmers. And it's important to recognize that farm choices will be affected by the implementation rules for each program that are currently being developed by the various agencies that manage those programs within USDA. And again, this is a very important question, and there's still a great deal of ambiguity about how the programs will be managed. For example, as I'll discuss a little later, there's an issue with base updating. Farmers in the Act are given the choice of staying with the existing base acres and yields that they have used to receive direct payments under the direct payments program or countercyclical payments under the countercyclical payments program. But they will be given the opportunity to update those bases. There are complex issues associated with particularly cotton acreage that is because of the nature of the change in the cotton program, the shift really effectively into mainly what's called the stacked income protection program that's embedded in the new farm bill. The stacks program, by the way, can best be thought of as simply a more attractive version of the special coverage option. They're really very similar programs. And while we're talking about cotton, in some senses, cotton producers are fortunate because they really do only have to worry about, am I going to participate in the stacks program and what do I do with my orphaned cotton base acres? Now, I'm not going to get into the details of cotton orphaned base acres. That's for a future webinar. But for cotton producers, that's a very interesting issue, and what they do will be heavily dependent on the implementation rules that are developed by the Farm Service Agency. So what's not in the bill? What's gone? Well, direct payments, as we all know, about $4.9 billion worth a year of direct payments to farmers, checks that come through the mail January or February or December. Well, they're gone. No more direct payments. The ACRE program, which is the original shallow loss program developed in the 2008 Farm Bill, that's gone. No more ACRE. It's been replaced by price loss coverage and or agricultural risk coverage. Countercyclical payments, well, they're gone, but not really, because in practice, the new price loss coverage program is essentially the countercyclical payments program with updated base yields, base acres, and much higher prices that will trigger payments. And that's another issue that I'll talk about in a little while. The SURE program, the supplementary revenue program for crops, the disaster aid program that was tied into a variety of other programs, that's gone. and the Dairy Price Support Program and Milk Income Loss Contract Program, those are all gone to be replaced by the new Dairy Margin Program, which some people call insurance because you can buy up to get additional coverage. But quite a few of the programs that are being referred to commonly as if they're insurance are really subsidy programs rather than insurance programs. So the exceptions are STACS and the and the Supplementary Coverage Option Program. Well, what's new? Well, we've got what I've called the Big Four in Titles 1 and 11. So Title 1 is the traditional commodities program title, and Title 11 is crop insurance. Well, the first new program is PLC, Price Loss Coverage. In that program, payments will be made when they're available on historically determined payment acres with higher support prices than under the countercyclical payments program. How much higher? A lot higher, and this is pretty well known, but I'll illustrate the issue in later in the discussion. The Agricultural Risk Coverage Program, that is also a program in which payments will be made on historically determined payment acres, again with a different structure of support than has previously existed. The Agricultural Risk Coverage Program is a program under which, using the five previous years of estimated revenues, either at the county or the farm level, a proven, if you like, revenue is established on a per acre basis. When at either the county or the farm level, depending on which option chosen by the farmer is utilized, the estimated revenue per acre falls below 86% of the established expected revenue, payment is made. And that payment is capped at 10% of the expected revenue, which is the five-year average, computed using the Olympic average method, which I always think of as the Russian judge method in figure skating. You drop the high and the low marks, in this case, the high and the low revenues. Price Loss Coverage Program is really a countercyclical payments program where payments will be triggered when prices fall below, on a national average basis, the reference levels, which you can think of as the trigger price levels for payments. There is base updating at the farmer's choice. And the farmer's choice is a real choice here because for some crops, base updating is clearly preferred. They will get much larger amount of production on which they will be paid when payments are available. For other crops, base updating may not be as attractive. It just depends on each farm situation. And then we have the supplementary coverage option, which is a new insurance program. It is a group risk insurance program under which when whatever is being insured, and this is going to be at the county level, falls below 86% of its expected value, payments will be made. Those payments are capped at the difference between whatever the farmer has chosen as their underlying insurance product, say a multiple peril insurance product in terms of coverage, say 70%, and 86%. So in that case, the farmer would get a maximum 16% of their expected revenue under the contract as a payment, all of which is wonderfully simple. And then the Cotton Stacks program is essentially an expanded and more heavily subsidized SCO group-based insurance program. It will be based on the county or crop reporting district level, depending on the data that the National Agricultural Statistical Service have available. The subsidy will be 80% of the expected indemnity under the program. That is 80% of the expected actuarially fair premium for the coverage. So that's sort of a program where if you put a dollar down, on average, you're going to get $5 back. Sort of deal that I'd love to have in Las Vegas. Other changes in farm subsidy programs. Well, in the Title I has the Livestock Indemnity and Livestock Forage Disaster Aid programs. Both of those are refunded and will be implemented retroactively for losses of forage or exceptional losses of livestock or morbidity of livestock in 2012 and 2013. And FSA is moving very quickly on implementing these programs for 2012 and 2013, with implementation rules being developed right now, perhaps almost complete, and farm applications being expected, I believe, either March 15th or April 15th as the beginning date for applications. So that's a major issue for education on the part of the extension program. And then we have the new milk producer program called the Dairy Margin Protection Program. There's a great deal of debate in the farm bill about whether or not there should be supply controls attached to this participation in this program. That proposal was killed eventually at the insistence of the Speaker of the House. But so there's no supply control embedded in this program. But if you're a smaller dairy farm, you'll get larger subsidies on a per hundredweight of milk program under this program than will larger dairy farms. And that's all I'm going to say about dairy. It's a complex issue, and it deserves its own program. We've got the Conservation Reserve Program, and that will continue. With funding for only 25 million acres by 2016, and funding is scheduled at about 1.2 billion a year. Now, this is an interesting issue because the farm lobbies were very supportive of reductions in the Conservation Reserve Program when they expected corn prices to be more in the $5 or $6 range, and commensurately prices for other small grains and oil seeds to be relatively high. With expected moderation in those prices, the Conservation Reserve Program will be somewhat more appealing to many of the lobbying groups for farmers, and it's not clear to anyone that over the next 2 years we wouldn't see modifications to the amount of acreage that goes in that program. It depends on what happens to the price of corn, the price of wheat, and so on. Other conservation programs will be combined under the Act, for example, the various conservation easement and reserve programs. R&D funding for public research may be increased. We've seen an increase in appropriations by the Agricultural Appropriations Committee for this coming year. There's no indication there will be reductions in public R&D spending, and that's probably a very good thing, given most of the evidence on the gains and on the benefits from publicly funded agricultural research for pretty much everybody in the country. Farm subsidy program payment limits, well, no major changes to payment limits, even though there's a great deal of discussion in the debates over the farm bill about tightening restrictions on availability of subsidies. Payments per farm under the price loss coverage and agricultural risk coverage programs are notionally capped at about $250,000. Exactly $250,000, assuming that there are two eligible persons per farm to receive subsidies. That's a little more complicated world, and again, this is an overview rather than a detailed discussion of payment limits. But that's a big change from what might have been expected a year ago, where payment limits were given a great deal of focus. There are some restrictions on the absolute amount of disaster aid payments a farm can receive, about $100,000 a year. There are no limits on crop insurance premium subsidies whatsoever. Again, this was an issue that received a great deal of attention, involved a proposed amendment to the House bill that failed to pass by just a few votes. But in the end, the committees were strongly supportive of no limits on crop insurance premium subsidies in the House and Senate. How much budget savings are there in the bill? Well, CBO has estimated $1.6 billion a year. Spending on farm programs, that's the red tip of what looks like two cigarettes, down from $20.8 billion, which is the estimate of what they would be if the 2008 farm bill were continued. to 20 million under the 2014 Farm Bill. Nutrition cuts would be about 800 million a year, down from 76.4 billion to 75.6 billion. But those numbers are probably wrong. The CBO used relatively high prices for corn, wheat, and so on in estimating the costs of the 2014 Farm Bill, and USDA has put out some recent estimates of much lower prices for corn, wheat, and soybeans that imply much larger spending on agricultural subsidies than CBO estimated, given it was required to use a relatively high price baseline to calculate the costs of programs like price loss coverage and the agricultural risk coverage program. Let's talk for just a few moments about the PLC AGR choice. That should be the PLC ARC choice, agricultural risk coverage choice. A farm that chooses the PLC does so for all eligible crops for the entire length of the 2014 Farm Bill. That's through 2018. If the farm opts for PLC, then it can also use SCO insurance coverage for individual covered crops. Under the PLC, payments will be made on 85% of a farm's production base for each crop. And if the farm purchases a special coverage option, then it has to make a simultaneous choice about coverage levels in the SCO and its APH-based, typically this is going to be what's called the combo product, that is an actual production history, individual farm insurance program, or another underlying federally subsidized insurance contract for each crop. The two options are linked, and those are going to be decisions that have to be made by the farm. Under the Agricultural Risk Coverage Program, the farm choosing ARC does so for all eligible crops for the entire duration of the bill. If it picks the county option, it's paid on 85% of eligible production. If it goes for the individual farm option, where the difference is you're using county yields and the county option and your own farm's yields and your own farm's option, you only get paid on 65% of eligible production. That's a pretty hefty penalty, by the way, for opting to use your own farm yields to establish the farm's per acre expected revenue. If the farm opts for ARC, it cannot participate in the SCO program. They cover the same sorts of losses. The farm can still purchase any underlying federally subsidized crop insurance contract, although given that the ARC shell loss program, the farm may choose to reconsider coverage levels that it selects under its preferred underlying crop insurance contract, say its APH revenue contract. Lots of choices there, lots of decisions to make at the margin, not easy decisions. And decisions that will be driven in part or very much particularly what farmers expect prices for the crops they produce or most of their land is allocated to do. So let's just reflect on that again for a few minutes. What I put up here is numbers that many of you have seen before. But we're showing the original countercyclical payments payment trigger, which for corn was $2.35 a bushel. Under price loss coverage, which is simply an updated countercyclical payments program, the price triggering payments would be $3.70 per bushel for corn. That's a 57% increase. For wheat, the trigger price has gone from $3.65 to $5.50. So a trigger price, when the national average price falls below those numbers, say $5.50 for wheat, then you would get a payment under price loss coverage. For soybeans, we've had a 66% increase in the trigger price. For peanuts, we have a 17% increase. But if you look at the prices for peanuts historically, $5.35 a ton exceeds the national average price for peanuts in 10 of the previous 12 years. And payments are expected under that program this coming year. For rice, we've seen a 72% increase in the trigger price, although rice prices, as I'll show you very shortly, are expected largely to be above $14 over the next 5 or 6 years, at least according to recent USDA predictions. And for barley, we've seen a 107% increase in the payment trigger. These are substantial changes intended to make these price loss coverage more attractive, meaning more lucrative for most farmers than the countercyclical payments program. Well, if we look at what I've put up now, this is just a history of corn, soybean, and wheat prices. Corn is in red, wheat is in yellow, and soybeans are in green. And as everybody knows, those prices have been relatively high or very high from about 2007 on compared to long-run historical averages. The story for here, we've got rice in blue, peanuts in brown, cotton in black. Story for those commodities is somewhat different. Lots of volatility, not much trend except a little bit of an upward trend for rice, but no trend for peanuts or cotton. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to spend much time on peanuts, rice, and cotton, with apologies to everybody in Georgia and California and Arkansas. And I'm going to focus just on corn, wheat, and soybeans. Here, I'm showing you the most recent USDA forecasts for prices for these commodities over the period 2013-14 to 17-18, the period covered by the Act. The dotted lines are the prices that under the PLC program would trigger payments. And if you look at soybeans, prices don't look as though they're likely to trigger any payments for soybeans over that period. So if you only produce soybeans, because it is still the case that there's a downward trend in those prices, you're likely to go for agricultural risk coverage. But of course, we know that most soybeans are raised by farms that combine soybean production with corn production, at least in the I states, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and related states like Ohio, related in the sense that they're the corn belt. And for corn, we see that in several years, corn prices are going to be below, and it doesn't look by much, but it is fairly substantially below the new reference price or trigger price for payments under price loss coverage. So corn growers have to think a little bit about whether they want to go into ARC or PLC, because prices for corn look like they're going to decline. And then for wheat, it looks very much like prices for wheat, at least according to USDA estimates, are going to be well below their trigger price, and so price loss coverage may look very attractive for wheat. Here's the problem. The futures prices for those crops are substantially higher. The futures prices at a time of harvest, say in December 2015 and September 2015 for corn and wheat, are much higher than those being predicted by USDA. So there's a lot of ambiguity about where prices are going to go. And if your prices are declining for your crop, but above price loss coverage trigger reference prices, you're really going to find ARC likely to be very interesting to you. So here's the dilemma, of course. Nobody really knows where the prices of these crops are going. So lots of ambiguity there. So finally, I want to spend one or two moments talking about base updating. Farmers will be given a choice between keeping their current base for each crop or updating yields. And that choice may be clear-cut for some producers and less clear-cut for other producers. And just to illustrate the issue, I'm just going to show you a table drawn from a piece of work done by Barry Goodwin and myself quite recently, where we looked at what would happen with base updating simply to direct payments if they stayed around. And that's just illustrative. And you can see that for corn, the percentage change in the base amount of production eligible for payments is substantially higher if you update, 23.1% higher, effectively. And the same is true for soybeans, very much substantially higher in the case of soybeans. But for some other crops, for example, cotton and wheat, because of substantial declines in acreage allocated to those crops, and rice would be in the same position, not because of declines in yields. Yields, base yields have grown substantially since 2002, when you were last allowed to base update. But what these numbers tell us is there's a lot of complexity here for each farmer in deciding whether or not to base update. And so it's going to be very important for extension educators to look at the issue of base updating for us to correctly model and explain what the implications of base updating will be. And the truth is we can only do that when we know the implementation rules. So there it's a little bit of a wait and see. Take-home messages. Well, the evidence is that at least since 2002, when farm subsidy programs changed, they become more complicated. And the House and Senate Ag Committees have done their level best to ensure, therefore, that there'll be lots of work for agricultural economists and extension educators, so we should be very grateful to them for that. And the real question for the farm sector in deciding among the new programs, above anything else, is sorting out what they think will happen to the prices of major crops over the next 5 years. And that, in truth, is very tricky. That may depend in some part on whether or not the renewable fuels mandate will be enforced or effectively allowed to atrophy, or whether it will be abandoned. And along with that, whether or not USDA, as the Secretary indicated last week, will do its level best to find new subsidies for ethanol plants. So lots of ambiguities here, lots of things to sort out, but hopefully this overview has been helpful for you. Thank you.
Oh, Vince, thank you for those excellent comments. Very insightful and helps to draw some clarity to what is somewhat of a confusing situation at present. So again, thank you very much for those. We have a number of questions that have come in here. And so what I'd like to do is ask just a couple of them now, and then we'll have a panel discussion of all three of our presenters at the end. So the first of those questions comes in here is are payments decoupled from production?
Great question, and the answer is depends on the prism through which you're looking at them. These are all amber box payments under PLC and ARC when it comes to the World Trade Organization under the terms of the Marrakesh Treaty and the Agricultural Annex. Are they decoupled? That's a much more complicated question. And on a bad day, I can make a case that they are decoupled. On another bad day, I can make the case that they are not decoupled. The evidence is that they are going to be based on recent historical production. However, one of the problems with true decoupling is that if you say we're going to update base every farm bill or every other, or we're likely to, then you've just recoupled some of that farm decision. Now, not very much. Under the WTO rules, however, it's unambiguous because payments are going to be triggered by current market conditions, prices, and by yields, current yields. These have to be declared to be amber box programs.
Okay, great. And to kind of follow up on that, another participant asks, do farmers or landowners have the final say on updating those base acres, or do we know enough details to answer that yet?
Well, there's a lot of language in the bill on who gets to choose what's what. One reading of the bill would be that the farmer and the landowner may be able to make different decisions, which would be really quite administratively hair-raising. So I'm going to take the fifth on that and say, let's see what the implementation rules say. It's very clear that for base updating, the lessee and the lessor will have to sit down and sort that one out. It's also the case that the lessee and the lessor will have to sit down and sort out which program they're going to go into assuming they're going to participate in the program? Are they going to go into the agricultural risk coverage program or price loss coverage program? And those are questions that will have to be sorted out. But we do need to wait for implementation rules to some extent, and I believe. One of our next speakers may be more adequately able to address that question.
We do have Jonathan on the dock to actually address the implementation to some degree. There's one other question, though, that's kind of tied to that I thought I'd put to you, Vince, and that is the questioner asks, when do we anticipate the new programs of PLC and ARC to become effective?
I have no clue. It depends on whose claims you believe. It will be any time, in my judgment, between June 15th and July 31st. Pick a date. The real challenge is getting the implementation rules sorted out, making sure, going through the Federal Register process for these implementation rules, and there will be politics involved. I am sure that various lobbying groups will have a lot to say about preliminary proposals, one way or the other.
I'm sure you're right. And so, in the interest of time, first let me say thank you again very much, Vince. Excellent comments and answers. Hopefully you'll be able to stay with us to take a few more at the end.
be happy to do it.
We'll move now to our next presenter, who is Jonathan Koppus, who's recently joined the faculty at the University of Illinois as a clinical assistant professor of law and policy in the College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics. Previously, Jonathan served as chief counsel of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry for Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow. Prior to joining the Ag Committee, he was administrator of the Farm Service Agency at the USDA. And before becoming appointed to the USDA position, Jonathan was a legislative assistant for Senator Ben Nelson. Jonathan grew up on his family's corn and soybean farm in western Ohio and practiced law in Chicago before moving to Washington to work on agricultural policy. He earned his bachelor's from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and his Juris Doctor from the George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C. It is indeed a pleasure and an honor to welcome Jonathan today. Thank you for joining us, and we very much look forward to your comments and insights.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here, and I hope to shed maybe a little bit of light on what is certainly a process and at times a complex process on how the statute gets put into action through the regulations and the implementation process. So I'm going to provide a pretty high-level overview of what this process looks like and leave as much time as possible for questions. I know there are a lot of questions out there about how this is going to work. The first thing I would note, if you saw in the news, the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Vilsack, made a little bit of news down at the Commodity Classic the other day, in which he stated, or it was reported that the Secretary stated there that sign-up for the programs, for the price loss coverage and the agriculture risk coverage programs, is not likely to happen until sometime this fall. There were no dates, there's no deadlines put in place yet, but they certainly are looking at the fall timeline as when this might come about. So that was announced this morning, which kind of leads to the question then, what's going to take so long, or why is it taking so long? Let's go through the general steps for regulation. I mean, the very first thing that happens now with the bills down at USDA is the agency, in this case the Farm Service Agency, and more specifically the Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs within the agency, then starts the process of writing the regulation. This is sort of filling in all the blanks in the statutory language, defining everything and moving through how the program is going to operate. Once the agency writes the regulation, it goes through a departmental clearance process. That's back through the Secretary's office and the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Agriculture. And then it would go to the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, and this goes through another review process. It's called an interagency review and clearance process, in which other parts of the federal government, other departments, the EPA and others review this process to make sure that there's not conflicts or other issues with laws and statutes under their jurisdiction. And then once that happens, it typically will go to the Federal Register, where it goes up for public review and comment. The standard process is that this is posted. Members of the public then have time, sometimes 30, 60, 90 or more days, to write comments on the regulation. There's also a time built in here for the congressional committees and for members of Congress to review and provide comments. And then all of that goes back into the agency, back to the regulatory writers in the agency, who then have to answer every comment or respond to every comment, and then make adjustments to the rule based on all the feedback that's come through the system, or not. There's no requirement they actually change the rule from the way it was proposed. But once the comment period is over, then they put the final, and it goes back through the departmental and then the OMB review processes again. Then it's finalized and published in the Federal Register and becomes an effective final rule. So as you can see, there's quite a process to get through there. That's for the normal regulatory process. Now, programs in Title I of the Farm Bill, so the commodity programs, as well as the supplemental coverage option and stacks, all have what is called expedited rulemaking authority. This is specific language in the Farm Bill that permits the Farm Service Agency to bypass certain steps or requirements in the normal process. Mostly what we're looking at is the public notice and comment period and the congressional review period are basically not required for the regulations for Title I programs, and from this Farm Bill, this includes stacks and SCO as well. They're expedited through the process. Now, in the bill, the Secretary is instructed to have the regulations out within 90 days, but this is rarely, if ever, accomplished, and certainly with the complexities in these programs is not expected in this Farm Bill. So in this expedited process, we go back to the same place we started before. These regulations are written at the agency. The agency also is going to have to undertake writing or creating the software that will operate the programs and make the payments. So it isn't just that they're writing the regulation. They've got an entire crew of information technology people, members of the agency, that will design the software to run these programs out in the county offices. And they also have to write the handbooks and the other material that we consider to be the guidance for the field staff. If you you guys are probably all very familiar with how FSA operates, as it has over 2,000 offices in the counties across the country, and that's where a lot of the on-the-ground work happens, where farmers go in and sign up. And so there has to be guidance, there has to be handbooks and everything for those field staff to run the programs. And, of course, there's going to be an effort to train the field staff as this progresses. So you can see quite a process just at the agency level as well. While we are on an expedited review or an expedited rulemaking process for FSA regs, for the farm program regs, they still have to go through departmental review and some level of review at the Office of Management Budget, so that does take a significant amount of time. As I mentioned, software, you've probably heard about this in many forms and many different opinions and thoughts on this, but the software challenges at FSA have been significant. They were a significant challenge in implementing the 2008 Farm Bill. It can be expected they will continue to be a challenge, but with these programs, as they become complex and the decisions and the multiple farm entity issues that you got to sort through, this software is a challenge, and we can expect that to take significant amount of time. And of course, as Professor Smith just went through trying to explain a first round of these programs, explaining them to field staff and working through the training and all the efforts that have to go on in order to permit them to be effective, to provide what is in effect customer service, there's quite a bit of training that has to go on there. And as mentioned, what we have complicating this process are the complexity of the program. So we've got a price-based program, the PLC program, and we have two different versions of a revenue program under the ARC acronym. And farmers are choosing among those programs. If it's PLC and ARC county, they can go commodity by commodity. The ARC individual has this multiple commodity calculation, which are adding across the multiple program crops. Those are extraordinarily complex. from an administrative standpoint, not just for the regulation, writing the regulations, but even probably more complex in trying to put software together and get the programs operational. So that is a big, big challenge. As was mentioned previously, we have multiple decisions now that have to be made by farmers and landowners. So you've got base acre reallocation decision, you've got a payment yield update decision, and then you have the decisions on the programs and how those will play out. Between farmers and landowners, these programs all pay on base acres, so the landowner is certainly involved in this process. And as we mentioned, the IT challenges are substantial, budgetary challenges at FSA and staffing challenges that come out of the budget reductions that the agency has seen in the last 5 to 8 years now have added to the challenges for the agency, both in writing software and having the capability on the IT side, as well as having the staff at the local offices all the way up into the national headquarters program writing offices. So quite a few challenges added to this process for the agency. And then just to make it even more complex, we also have various issues with planting and harvest dates for the various commodities. So this regulatory writing process will be taking place. We've already got wheat in the ground across the country. Corn and soybeans and other spring planted crops will be happening. And then obviously even harvest dates, if we're talking about the fall, that's going to complicate the process. That's going to complicate dates and sign-up capabilities. And it also adds to some of the issues about, you know, what will farmers know when they go into the office? If we're talking late fall, then that means almost all of these crops will have been harvested. We'll know prices. We'll know yields. That'll impact farmers' decisions, and it'll certainly will have some impact. Now, I think as was mentioned previously, the programs as they operate use the marketing year average. So for corn and soybeans, your marketing year will begin in September of 2014 and run all the way around to August of 2015. So no payments actually will come out in the 2014 crop or the 2014 calendar year. The 2014 crop year will be paid a year delayed, if you will, be paid out in October of 2015. So there is time in that regard. But you know, one of the complicating factors is that these programs begin operating for this crop year, and so decisions will have to be made for 2014 crop year while all of these other matters are going on. So hopefully that provides a little bit of an overview and maybe some areas or some explanation of why it takes so much time and why it has become so complex. And I think a great question that came up in putting this together was, well, what do we do in the meantime? And certainly where there's strong interest, and from what I've heard in meetings and discussions thus far, there's some significant concern from farmers and crop insurance agents and others involved in this process, particularly about the decisions and what all this means for their farm and for their operations, both the acres they own, the acres they rent, how they deal with landlords. And so there's a lot of questions and information out there. So we can also look at a parallel education process that can go on as these things are put together. Certainly things like this webinar today and others that can help build an understanding, explain what's in the bill, explain the provisions and the programs and how the operational, some of what we can see on the operational side of it, and help with the decisions. Are there, you know, the tools that can provide analysis, that can guide farmers to help them understand? I think Dr. Smith made the comment that, you know, a big part of this is going to be sort of farmers' willingness or ability to project or forecast prices out in the future, and that's going to be a big part of the decision making on these program decisions. And to the extent that information can be put together, that analysis and other sort of decision aiding tools can be put together, then that will be a big part of it as well. And that'll allow information to get to the farmers, allow them to talk to their landlords, deal with their bankers, look at their crop insurance purchase, their risk management decisions on their farm, and hopefully by the time the agency's ready to begin sign up, there will be a lot of there'll be a lot of information out there for farmers, and that should help smooth the decision making process and maybe even sign up. That's certainly the optimistic view. We'll see how it all plays out in the coming months. With that, I do want to put a plug in for the work we're doing here at the University of Illinois. Particularly FarmDoc Daily and the FarmDoc site, where we will be putting out weekly posts on different issues for the Farm Bill, particularly for Title I and crop insurance. And this week we're doing a webinar on the details of the farm programs in the commodity programs in Title I. That'll be on Wednesday, March 5th at 8 a.m. Central Time. And with that, happy to take some questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for your observations and keen insights on how this rulemaking process works. We've got a number of questions come in here, probably drawing heavily from your experience and expertise as far as how the process works. The first one asks, does President Obama's announcement on expediting the livestock disaster program impact its time frame for implementation, and what is the time frame expected for livestock disaster programs?
Yeah, I believe USDA has announced that sign up for the livestock disaster programs. That's the Livestock Indemnity Program, LIP, and Livestock Forage Program, LFP, the ELAP program, which is another emergency livestock assistance program, and then the tree assistance program. Those signups are currently scheduled in April, I do believe, is the announcement I saw from USDA. Certainly having the president weigh in, the secretary weigh in and say this is a matter that needs to be expedited helps. These programs also were not substantially changed from the 2008 Farm Bill, from the programs that were ran out of that Farm Bill that they actually expired back in 2011. This Farm Bill will pick those up for 2012 and run them out through 2018. So from the agency and the rulemaking process, it's a lot easier because there are not substantial changes. So these programs can be picked up. They were basically put on the shelf back in 2011. That's using a very simplified metaphor, but they were sort of put on the shelf, if you will, in 2011, and they can be pulled back and updated and operated much quicker and easier, which is why you're seeing this timeline. Also, the secretary and the president made the point that with the drought and the suffering in the livestock industry from the last couple of years, the need for these programs is substantially stronger and more immediate for those producers.
Right. So here's another question that's kind of tied to that. Came in a bit earlier, but I think you've just touched on it. When we start talking about these years, 2012, 2013, 2011, are we talking about the fiscal year? Or are we talking about calendar year as far as the Farm Bill is concerned?
That's a great question, and not to make light of it, but to make everything as confusing as possible, we use multiple years depending on what we're talking about. The disaster programs ran on fiscal year, so they expired with fiscal year 2011. The commodity programs in Title I run on the program crop year, they run on a crop year basis, and they include things like the marketing year average. So you actually have what comes out to be multiple calendars that we're using. So depending on which program you're talking about, the PLC ARC programs will be on a crop year. So beginning with the 2014 crop year, which for corn and soybeans is planting, will be planted this spring and harvested in the fall. For wheat, it was planted last fall and will be harvested this year, this calendar year. But those programs operate on a crop year basis.
Okay. Well, it is more complicated, isn't it? So one other question then that kind of follows again on your experience here, because a lot of folks don't understand what goes on in a lot of ways behind the scenes. But how much lobbying input is asserted at the agency rulemaking phase of the game? Any insights you can share with us on that?
Obviously, we use the term lobbying maybe to cover a very wide variety of activities. Certainly, members of Congress, through the oversight capabilities, will be keeping a close eye on this process and will have a lot of influence, and they will meet with the various interest groups that have been working on this throughout the 3-year Farm Bill process. There are opportunities for meetings with the agency, so commodity groups can meet with the agency. There are opportunities to meet at OMB, to meet at the departmental level. There are, however, some rules and restrictions as far as while a regulation is under development consideration, people have to be careful within the agency and at all levels of the executive on how you treat it, and that you don't have these sort of meetings that may influence the process unfairly. So there'll be, you know, there's sort of a variety of how that goes on, but there will be a lot of input provided at all levels as this process goes forward. And sometimes that can complicate matters. Sometimes it can help clarify. Certainly, when Congress is able to explain some of the areas that are maybe not as clear, when they can provide more input, that can be helpful as well. But you will see quite a bit of activity and discussions. There's a series of rules, and not to get too complicated about it, but it can be a little bit more restricted maybe than what some folks would think normally.
All right. Well, thank you again very much for those insights. Having that understanding that you have of the behind-the-scenes work is really invaluable in some ways to understanding what's going on as far as the game at this stage of where things are in the proceeding for rollout, for producer decision-making and so on. So hopefully you'll be able to stay with us. There's a number of other questions that come in specifically for you, looks like. But in the interest of time and to make sure we give enough time for our third presenter, we'll go ahead and move now to our third and final presentation for today's webinar, who is Dr. Nathan Smith, who is an associate professor and extension economist with the University of Georgia. He's located on the Tifton campus in Tifton, Georgia, where his major responsibilities are production economics, marketing and policy for peanuts, grains, and soybeans. He also has risk management program responsibilities and works with Georgia peanut growers on value-added prospects and ventures. In addition, he's developed public policy education programs since the beginning of the debate for the 2002 Farm Bill. Nathan was an extension marketing specialist for row crops at the University of Arkansas before coming to the University of Georgia. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree from Clemson University, Master of Science degree from Auburn University, and a PhD from the University of Kentucky, all in agricultural economics. Dr. Smith lives in Tifton with his wife and two sons, and I want to thank you very much, Nathan, for joining us today. We'll now turn it over to you.
Thank you, John, and hello to everybody connected live and to those who will be watching this later. We certainly appreciate everybody joining in, and I'm glad to see the interest in what's in the Farm Bill. I won't take too long. I'll just take a minute to kind of share with you how these webinars came along, talk of just a minute about maybe what will be coming down in the future through this National Farm Bill Consortium. This webinar and a series of webinars that to come was basically came through a group of extension specialists around the country that we're kind of loosely calling a consortium of participants. And this consortium is made up of SARA 39, Public Policy Issues, Education, Information Exchange Group, the Regional Risk Management Education Centers, and the Regional Extension Farm Management Committees. And so the idea was to put together a type of education program that can help other extension specialists and around the country and in different regions to get a better handle and understanding of the Farm Bill and what's in the new Farm Bill. So we thank Dr. Vince Smith and Jonathan Copas for their presentations, excellent presentations, really kicked it off great. What's coming down the road is hopefully four more webinars beginning on March 17, targeting dairy and livestock, and then March 24, targeting commodity programs and crop insurance, and then March 31st, hopefully targeting conservation, horticulture, and beginning farmers will be the targets for that. And then April 7th, a discussion on nutrition and food policy programs. So those are the plans for the webinars. We also have as sponsors, as John mentioned in the beginning, not only with those in the consortium, but with the Ag, we certainly appreciate Ag in uncertain times as being the host and Montana State working the webinar, as well as AAEA Extension Section and CFAIR. So, you know, the goals of this National Extension Consortium is to deliver the webinar series on what's in the Farm Bill and potential impacts, but also, as in years past, like the 2002 and 2008 Farm Bills, some of you may have attended a national conference, a train-to-trainer type conference for extension professionals. That's in discussion. And hopefully as we get the rules and regs come out and so that we can look at better being able to design decision aids and provide information on decision making, that we'll have the conference, be able to plan a conference with policy experts and provide resources for education and training out in your area, your region, or your state. So, again, I just want to thank everybody for their participation, John. Just to say stay tuned as we have more webinars and as we learn more of the details with the rules and regs of the Farm Bill. So, John, that's pretty much all I wanted to cover, and we'll be glad to turn it back over to you. If there's a question, certainly can try to take it.
Okay, so you did mention, if I'm correct, Nathan, that there's to be a program that we're going to do in the near future covering the dairy program explicitly. There's a question that had come in earlier regarding that.
Right. The next webinar is going to be targeted at dairy and livestock disaster programs, since those are certainly, as was mentioned earlier, seem to be the most pressing in terms of what will be rolled out from the Farm Bill.
Okay, great. We do have quite a few more questions. I suspect we may not have enough time to get across all of them. We'll make an attempt at it. One question I think would be related, Vince, to the presentation you gave, asking about the base. It says in base, when we are updating that base acreage, will acres and yields be available for update, or will it be limited as far as your understanding of how things are set up at this point?
Oh, no, it's definitively both acres and yields. It's a complex little world, but your yields, your base acres, your total farm-wide base acres are fixed, but how you allocate them between crops is contingent on what you planted over the last 4 years, by which they mean, I think, 2009, 10, 11, and 12. So you can reallocate those that total base acreage among the crops you raised over that four-year period according to the proportion of your land you put into each crop. Your yields can be updated using a five-year period, which would be 2008 through 2012, and your payment yield, your adjusted yield would be 90% of that average. That's a huge deal for crops like corn and soybeans, where yields have really jumped since the mid-80s and also since 2002. That's a big deal. So you update both your yields and your acres in the sense of how you allocate, say, the 4,000 acres of base or the 1,000 acres of base that your farm currently has. The yield updating is hugely beneficial under any criterion for most crops. One point that I want to make on PLC, John, whilst we're at it, is that Jonathan Coppice is correct. You can choose, say, PLC for wheat and ARC at the county level for corn. So my slide on that is incorrect, and Jonathan is entirely correct. I just wanted to get that in case we skip that question.
All right, great.
Now,
thank you for that. We have a question here. Maybe, Nathan, you could answer this. Is a little broader in scope. Question about, do any of the issues that we've been discussing this morning and or how do they affect the small producer and perhaps combined with that, fruits and vegetables? How are those crops handled as far as the new Farm Bill, and what are the implications for some of these detailed discussions that we're having this morning, and how will they affect those folks?
Right, that's a good question. So, understanding, I guess it's almost handle that in two parts. One being the small producer, and really, I guess when you look at the Title I and the fact that you can update bases and yields, and that payments are tied to that. It's really, goes to supporting production. And so, as far as the small producer, there's provision in there in the last farm bill where, smaller than 10 acres did not have payments, but there was exceptions for limited resource and disadvantaged farmers. So those, I'm assuming, will still be, in effect in terms of being able to receive payments on small bases or even small basers. When you look at all the titles, and I'm one of those, Vince, that didn't read all of the farm bill, that read the parts that are most pertinent to me, but there are programs like in the for specialty crops and for organic production. There's some programs in there, funding to grow those programs in those areas, farmers markets and so forth. Fruits and vegetables, the main money or support in there is for research and grants to do research on fruits and vegetables in the Hort title. There's also, when you're looking at bases and PLC and ARC payments going to farms with base, there's a restriction that any vegetables or fruits grown on base acres are not eligible for PLC. Those acres that are planted to a fruit or vegetable are not eligible for that crop. Now, in the last farm bill, it was for that particular year that it was grown in that crop, and we'll have to see the rules and regs to whether that would still be the same or not. Unless you had a previous history of, say, double cropping watermelons with grain sorghum, like that might happen here in Georgia. But I guess that's the best answer I have right now on that question.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. Looks like the next one I'd like to put to Jonathan. Apologize if you feel like it's unfair, but the questioner asked, based on your comments and insights, when do you believe more details will become available and known, especially for those details needed by producers to make some sort of a decision in going forward?
Yeah, and that's a bit of a tough question. I mean, I think kind of as I mentioned, between now and when the regulations come out of the department, the best that anybody can do is using the statutory language as sort of the way to build, whether it's models and spreadsheets and calculators to try to understand what payments would look like, as well as trying to answer these specific questions about base acres and payment yields and so on and so forth. So right now, I think we can continue to sort of sort through the bill and try and figure out what we know. But as far as sign up and the specific aspects of the program, that will have to wait until FSA publishes the regulation. Now, as I mentioned, there's an expedited process that won't have to go through the public review and comment time frame. So once they publish them, they would be expected to be final at that time. And so that's when we'll know a lot of these questions, a lot of the details, kind of, if you will, between the lines of the statutory language.
All right, great. Looks like maybe the next one would be best directed to Vince, given his comments. Vince, is the ARC program going to be less beneficial for states with larger counties, such as North Dakota or Montana, where the yield can vary significantly from east to west?
Well, that's a really tough question. I think the answer is that ARC is going to pay off more in counties where yields on average are more volatile than in counties where they're less volatile. So at the margin, if you're, say, corn in an Iowa county versus wheat in a western North Dakota county, ARC is going to pay off a little bit better on average, assuming a certain level of prices. But one thing to understand is that at the county level, most of the payments under the ARC program are going to be driven by price. just and price relative to its past 5-year average, dropping high and low prices from the series, because it turns out that yields are a lot less volatile at the county level in most counties than at the individual farm level. So although ARC is described as a revenue program, I think most people who've looked at this question carefully, people like Bruce Babcock and Barry Goodwin, have concluded that the major driver in payments is going to be price volatility rather than yield volatility. And there's a compounding factor here, which is sort of in the weeds, which is when yields are trending upwards and you're using an arithmetic average, you're going to understate the role of yields in the first place. So it really, while the question is interesting, I think the answer is it's not volatility within the county that matters so much, assuming you go for the county option. It's whether or not yields are more volatile in county X than county Y. And we sort of know the answer to that question. In the Midwest, for example, yields are a lot less volatile than in, say, West Texas for cotton, or West Texas for wheat, or Montana for anything.
Okay, thank you. Another one, perhaps Jonathan, this would be best directed to you, given your experience. It asks about limits on crop insurance premiums. What is it that you're anticipating that might actually come about regarding crop insurance subsidies for premiums for farmers under this farm bill?
Well, not for this farm bill, there were no limits put on crop insurance premium subsidy. There was a proposal that passed the Senate that would have put in place an adjusted gross income standard that would have reduced premium subsidy, but that was not included in the final conference report. So that should not, there shouldn't be any income type restrictions. There is a provision dealing with native sod for a limited number of states, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Montana, Minnesota, Iowa, where you could get an increase in your premium if you are planting on native sod. But as far as the AGI, the adjusted gross income, or any kind of cap on premium subsidy, there's nothing in this farm bill, so that should not change under this farm bill.
And this farm bill will be in place until when?
2018. So it'll run through the 2018 crop and calendar fiscal years.
Crop calendar.
Is that right, John? Just a quick question, Jonathan. Is that right, or is it September 30th as with previous farm bills?
Yeah, I mean, again, not to confuse the various calendars, but so for the ARC PLC program, they'll be in place through the 2018 crop year. The general authorities throughout the bill will sunset with fiscal year 2018. Dairy operates on a slightly different crop year. It actually it goes to December 31st. So, but 2018 is the general year that's used across the board. And then it'll go based on those commodities or based on those various calendar aspects.
Right, I understand. It's not so straightforward, right? It's rather complex.
Unfortunately, it's not completely straightforward, right? But it'll consider 2018 will be the next go the next time this has to be reauthorized.
Right. Well, thank you for that explanation. Someone had asked that earlier. Vince, another question for you. Question asks, how will county prices be determined for, say, barley and wheat? What's the process?
County prices in what context?
Under these new programs, as I understand the question.
Well, the county prices will not matter for ARC and PLC. It's the national average price over the crop year, as Jonathan laid out. So these new programs are not like the loan rate program, where you have a loan rate price at the national level, but you have county specific information. So the payments will be triggered on the basis of where for the national average price, where it relates to, in the case of PLC, the reference price. Is it higher or lower, and by how much? For ARC, county crop yields will be valued to calculate the expected revenue using national average crop year prices, and then the current county yield or your own farm's yield will be valued at the national average price for the crop year. So the county price issue is not relevant to the implementation of ARC and PLC, and nor will it be relevant to the insurance program, SCO, which, as Jonathan pointed out, won't be implemented until 2015.
Okay, another point here, Vince, since we have you up, clarifying perhaps a point you made earlier. So the question asks, did you say that farmers must choose between updated base acres versus the update of their program yields?
No, you choose between keeping what you have now versus your updated yields and base acres using a five-year average for the yields and a four-year average for the acres you plant.
All right, great. Jonathan, this is another question perhaps you've got a little bit of insight on. The questioner asks, why is there such a penalty on ARC between county at 85% to the farm 65% level?
Yeah, that's so I think part of it goes back to what Dr. Smith was saying, is that you've got just from the congressional sort of how to put the farm bill together and dealing with all the budgetary aspects and how the Congressional Budget Office estimates a program will cost. When you're dealing with the individual yields on a farm at this high end, at this 85, 86, up to some of the original proposals with 90%, that becomes extraordinarily expensive because it triggers a lot more, and it's going to trigger more often and often, and as well as triggering bigger payments. And so, when you move from the county to the individual, that gets more costly. And so, in order to afford the programs, then there had to be a reduction in the individual program, and so it pays on 65% of the base acres, but it includes all of the program crops on the farm. It's not a commodity-by-commodity situation, whereas the ARC county pays 85% of the base acres for each individual commodity. So the programs are designed slightly different, and the best answer I can give is that it gets very costly when these kind of programs are set at the farm level, and that's why you see that differential.
All right. Well, thank you for that explanation. I think that helps quite a little bit. And I want to thank all...
Well, can I just throw in a comment here, John?
Yes, you may.
This is also politics. A senator from my state heavily pushed for the individual ARC yield and really forced the issue. But others from other states were really not comfortable with the individual yield program. So there was a lot of horse trading going on within the committees, and this is a comment which I'm happy to make as a worthless old tenured full professor. In some ways, within the Senate committee in particular, and the House committee, the real push was to put was for the price loss coverage program, and or a county-level ARC. And there was a lot less interest beyond two or three major players in the game in the ARC. And at the end, you get a large discount. And it's not irrelevant that Senator Baucus has stepped out of the Senate, and people knew he was going to be stepping out of the Senate when the final decisions were made. I don't expect Jonathan to comment on that, but I think there's a lot of that going on.
Well, clearly it's a very political process all the way around. And
absolutely.
And yet, for folks on the ground out in the country, we need to make decisions as best we can and as best as we can understand the ins and outs of what has been written. So I want to thank all three of you again for your excellent comments and insights. I think it really helps to better understand what exactly has gone on within the bill, as well as setting the stage for not only webinars that we have upcoming, but also those that others will be sponsoring. So in the interest of time, and I apologize, we have a number of other really good questions that have come in from the audience. We'll try to get those answered and posted to the Ag and Uncertain webpage that we've noted the URL for, and I'll be offering a link here to in just a second to provide, again, some more insights as the speakers are able to provide in responses to those. But we mentioned at the beginning that this is a series. This webinar is just the first of a series that's beginning on the 2014 Farm Bill. Nathan mentioned these dates, March 17, March 24, March 31, and April 7 going forward, where we intend to try to cover in a little more detail what can be covered at the present time with what knowledge we have about the dairy margin program, livestock disaster programs, commodity programs, and specifically crop insurance there, conservation title, the number of implications, as well as the HORT, beginning farmer programs, and then finally touching on the nutrition title and the food policy programs with the last webinar. We'd also like to hear from you about other topics, anything that we've touched on today or other presentations you might like to see us try to host. You can offer those in the chat window there at the left, or we certainly would welcome your emails sent to information@farmmanagement.org. Again, any ideas that you might have for webinar topics. As mentioned earlier, the recordings and other information associated with this webinar, as well as a host of other webinars that have been pre-recorded and posted to the Ag and Uncertain Times website, are available at the URL on your screen. If you're interested in a copy of today's presentation slides, they are also available for download at that website. And finally, we've mentioned a whole host of different URLs. Both the speakers have included some, as well as some of our comments. And we have tried to capture those and put those into a file pod that's now on your screen. So you have a single reference for that information. You may download that now by simply clicking on the file name and then choosing the Save to My Computer button at the bottom, and that'll bring a copy local to your machine. Let me close by again extending our express thanks to all of today's speakers for their first-class presentations, providing an overview of the 2014 Farm Bill. I want to thank also our Ag and Uncertain Times team and the other assisting folks that have helped to sponsor this webinar, as well as to make the technology possible. We'd also like to thank all of you participants in today's webinar conference. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work. We hope to see you again in one of our upcoming webinars. Until then, we offer you our hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. And with that, for Ag in Uncertain Times, I'm John Hewlett.